The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Acute Coronary Syndromes is presented by Dr. Robert Bender.
Common, acute coronary syndrome. Acute coronary syndrome, so this is acute myocardial ischemia, and it includes the following three subgroups: unstable angina, non-ST elevation MI, and ST elevation myocardial infarction. You could lump together unstable angina and non-STEMI under a heading that you could call non-ST elevation acute coronary syndrome. And these actually make up by far the majority of patients that come in the hospital and have acute coronary syndrome. But part of the importance of separating out the non-ST elevation patients from the ST elevation patients is that it has a bearing on at least the immediate treatment of these patients in most instances. And this is just a diagram kind of showing you the breakdown. And you can see that the first important distinction is whether there's ST elevation or not. And obviously you need an EKG for that, so that's part of the initial decision-making process on these patients when you're trying to make decisions on triaging them. So, as you all know, that many patients come in the hospital with a problem that has nothing to do with their heart, and somebody gets a troponin and it's elevated, and I see on discharge summaries all the time that, you know, they're discharged with a diagnosis of non-STEMI. Well, that may be true, because the troponin is elevated, by definition, there was some sort of injury. However, acute coronary syndrome, when you label somebody as having an acute coronary syndrome, that implies that there's been acute change in plaque. And that's very important, because that's why we have all this antithrombotic therapy, right? When they come in, and then when they leave, and they're on dual antiplatelet therapy and so on. And that's because with acute coronary syndrome, there is acute change or destabilization of plaque with inflammation and acute thrombus formation. So different than the so-called type 2 or demand ischemia that is frequently seen in patients with non-cardiac illnesses that are in the hospital and have a mildly elevated troponin. Initial evaluation, history, physical, and EKG are the key. You do not need to wait for cardiac biomarkers to come back to make initial decisions on these patients. And really a complete rule out. In other words, someone comes in with chest discomfort and you're trying to rule them out for myocardial infarction. I know many ERs do 6 hours, but really, to really be absolutely certain, it probably takes a minimum of 8 hours. I'm not going to bore you with what constitutes typical angina. If everybody in this room does not know a story of typical angina when they hear that, then you probably shouldn't be taking boards anyway. But the importance of this slide is that about a third of patients with acute coronary syndrome will not have typical symptoms. They may have dyspnea or some very atypical pain pattern. So you have to be a little bit careful. And this tends to be older patients or females or people that have a history of diabetes. The importance of knowing about their past cardiac history, that sometimes will help with the triage of these patients, especially if they have a prior history of some sort of revascularization. Also, multiple coronary risk factors, we'll see how that comes into play as far as making decisions on the non-ST elevation patients. Physical exam, I kind of lump patients into, are they warm and stable? You know, you walk in the room, they look good, they're having some chest pain, but otherwise everything is fine, no signs of heart failure. Or are they warm but they have acute heart failure? That should raise red flags. And then there's the ones that are cold and unstable, and these are the ones that are really, you got to do something right away or they're going to die, okay? So I think the physical exam can certainly help you with that and should be able to be done fairly rapidly when you initially see these patients. Now, as already mentioned, the EKG, after the physical exam, the EKG is key as far as initial treatment decisions. So we have ST elevation or non-ST elevation. And just so you know that this is pretty straightforward. You need to have a greater than a millimeter and two contiguous leads, with the exception with except for these exceptions. But there are a couple other groups of patients that may not have a so-called typical ST elevation on the EKG, but are lumped into a STEMI, and that is new or presumed new left bundle branch block. So you have to be pretty sure of yourself as far as their clinical symptoms before you start doing aggressive things on somebody that has a left bundle. But if it's new or presumed new in the right clinical scenario, that also, these patients could be treated under the label of the ST elevation patients. In other words, they need acute reperfusion. And occasionally, this arrow is supposed to be down here at the baseline, but acute true posterior MI, and that's where you have ST segment depression, usually lead V1, V2, maybe down in, to V3 without ST elevation. But most of these patients are going to also have associated inferior ST elevation. So this usually occurs in the setting of an inferior STEMI, and you'll see posterior extension. So it's usually not an issue as far as figuring out, well, is this a STEMI, you know, and do I need to be concerned about sending them right to the cath lab? So part of the importance of the distinction on the EKG is that non-ST elevation acute coronary syndrome lytics are not indicated. Now, occasionally these patients may need to go emergently to the cath lab, but more often there's a delay, and sometimes you may even choose not to commit them to cath, and the, some of these patients, if they're low risk, may be treated medically at least initially. EKG, so this is first one, kind of a typical, here's an example of acute inferior infarction with inferior ST elevation. That's what I was talking about, the posterior extension. You can see kind of typical changes there, in especially in lead V2 with ST segment depression and an upright T wave. So if you took the EKG and turned it over and looked at it, it would look like kind of typical fireman hat sign with ST elevation, but this would be an acute inferior posterior STEMI, as opposed to this one where you have predominantly just ST segment depression, so not a STEMI. And here's a patient, no real significant ST segment changes, but you'll see there's pretty significant T wave inversions. I will say that generally, transient or acute ST segment changes are more worrisome than T wave changes. But if you know that these are acute and then they resolve with therapy, when you have T wave inversions across precordial leads, that is somewhat a worrisome, and frequently those patients will be found to have LAD disease. And this slide, which is essentially a normal EKG, is to remind everybody that you don't have to have an abnormal EKG to have an acute coronary syndrome. Likewise, not all abnormal EKGs are acute coronary syndrome. What's a diagnosis here? It's pretty straightforward. I tried to pick a kind of a typical. You can see there's diffuse ST elevation, right? See ST segments elevated almost everywhere except, and here's the key, AVR, a little bit of ST segment depression, and PR segment, a little bit depressed. So this is acute pericarditis. So not all chest pain with EKG changes or acute coronary syndrome. Not going to spend much time on biomarkers. I mean, most institutions now, troponin IRT, that's kind of the marker of choice, and we don't usually do much anymore with CPK and myoglobin. Troponin is a much better biomarker. But the only one issue is that it stays elevated Troponin T more, a little more than troponin I, but it can stay elevated for quite a long time. So sometimes that's a little bit confusing. When someone has an acute coronary syndrome, you intervene, send them home, and two or three days later, they're back in the ER with some atypical pain complaints, but the troponin's still elevated. So let's now shift our focus, talk about our reperfusion strategy. Now, this is with STEMIs, ST elevation, acute coronary syndrome. And your choices are to either give thrombolytic therapy or send them to the cath lab for primary PCI. There are two other categories that I will spend a moment at least defining, and that is rescue PCI. So these are patients that got lytic therapy but didn't result in reperfusion, so you send them emergently to the cath lab after lytic therapy. Then there's the patients that may be presented to a hospital that didn't have a cath lab, got lytic therapy, get transferred by the time they arrive at the transfer hospital. Their symptoms are gone. The EKG's resolved. They're doing well. And so they don't need to go emergently to the cath lab. But it is important to realize that infarct-related patency is a predictor of survival. That's why the choice of method of reperfusion is important, because you want to make sure you get that artery open and you want to do it soon. The greatest benefit in STEMI patients is the first 2 to 3 hours. And the benefit, as far as myocardial salvage and even prognosis, tapers off very rapidly after the first 2 to 3 hours. So that's why time is of the essence with these patients. We're not going to spend any time talking about which lytic agent to use if you have a patient that you need to treat with lytic therapy, but a lot of this frequently depends on what's on the formulary at the hospital that you work at. But you can see treating STEMIs with lytic therapy, the 90-minute patency rate, in other words, chance of having the artery open at 90 minutes, is pretty good, but not spectacular, 75% to 85%. And maybe more importantly, TIMI-3 flow. Now, TIMI flow is a subjective assessment of flow down the arteries. When you get the patient in the cath lab, you inject dye, and you look and you see, how does that dye flow down the artery? Does it flow down rapidly and perfuse distally? And without kind of going over all the specifics with that, it's just a measure of flow in the cath lab. And you can see with lytic therapy, you restore, and TIMI-3 flow is good. That's what you want to see. That's normal. You restore TIMI-3 flow in only about 50 to 60% of patients that are treated with lytic therapy. So not lytics are not as effective in the unstable patients. So the acute heart failure or frank shock, frequently lytics work even less well than the STEMI patients that are not that sick. So the ideal mode of reperfusion is usually to get them to the cath lab and do primary angioplasty. And these are the goals. These are in our national guidelines. You'd like first medical contact to device time. So from the time they have first medical contact until you're opening up that artery, you'd like to be able to accomplish that within 90 minutes. If they present to a hospital that is PCI capable. If they present to a hospital that is not PCI capable, they allow you about 120 minutes. So if you can't achieve that, these are the patients that you may decide to give lytic therapy to before you transfer them. You can see that the patency rate and TIMI-3, so-called normal flow down the culprit infarct artery after angioplasty exceeds 90%, so much better than lytic therapy, and that's why angioplasty is usually treatment of choice for STEMIs. What about medical therapy in STEMIs? So there's a lot of, P2Y12 inhibitors that, depending on the interventionalist or the hospital or whatever, that are used. But to make it simple, it's two antiplatelet agents, one of which is aspirin, and then you have to pick a P2Y12, and anticoagulant, which usually is going to be unfractionated heparin if you're going to be sending them to the cath lab. Okay, so two antiplatelet agents and an anticoagulant, at least initially. And this is kind of a summary. so that they present to a PCI-capable hospital. Treatment of choice for STEMI, primary PCI, and you should be able to accomplish that within 90 minutes of first medical contact. Present to a non-PCI hospital. This is where it's a little more dicey and a little more sophisticated clinical decision-making. If you think you can get them to a PCI-capable hospital in the cath lab and get that artery open within 120 minutes, then that's what you should do. And if you can't, that's when you want to consider lytic therapy and then transfer them. Rescue angioplasty, that's emergent PCI after failed lytic therapy. So a patient presents to a hospital that's not PCI capable, and they're given lytic therapy, and arrangements are made for transfer, and they arrive at the transfer hospital, and they're still having symptoms and or still significant ST segment changes, or they're hemodynamically unstable, so they need to go emergently to the cath lab despite having received lytic therapy with the intent that you're going to do angioplasty on them. So that's rescue angioplasty, so emergent PCI after failed lytic therapy. And then there is always the patient, the occasional patient, which we see that gets lytic therapy, gets transferred to a PCI-capable hospital, and they arrive and they're completely asymptomatic. ST elevation has resolved, and so usually we're not going to send them right to the cath lab. You can continue to treat them medically. But most of these patients really deserve to have at least a cath before they go home, and that is currently a class 2A indication, so probably in most patients. Now, we're going to shift to non-ST elevation acute coronary syndromes. Lytics are not indicated in these patients. How you treat them, there's two pathways. There's the patients that come in and you commit them to going to the cath lab at some point during their hospitalization. And there may be other patients that you decide that you're going to treat them with medical therapy, a so-called ischemia-guided strategy, and you don't commit them to going to the cath lab unless they have either spontaneous recurrence of symptoms during their hospitalization or afterwards, or they have evidence of ischemia on provocative testing, i.e. stress testing. And generally, the patients that you're going to pick for at least initial medical therapy and not recommend cath are the patients that are low-risk patients, and we'll talk about what determines low-risk, and occasionally those patients that come in and they have some other medical issue that really is a relative contraindication for them going to the cath lab. They have an elevated creatinine, and, you know, they're kind of, you think they're borderline as far as pushing them over the edge to needing renal replacement therapy if you give them dye in the cath labs. There's a number of medical scenarios you could come up with that are a relative contraindication. But most of these patients that are going to get ischemia-guided therapy are the low-risk patients. So what about medical therapy in non-ST elevation? That's what we're talking about now, non-ST elevation acute coronary syndrome. It's basically the same thing. In other words, two antiplatelet agents and an anticoagulant. So I don't think we need to kind of dice things up into which antiplatelet agent may be better than others, but nonetheless should be aspirin, one other antiplatelet agent, and then an anticoagulant. And these are just the choices. So risk stratification, as I already mentioned, you may, when a patient with non-ST elevation acute coronary syndrome come in, you may elect not to commit them to going to the cath lab. And if you do that, you need to continue to have some sense of what their risk of future event is. Because if that risk is high, or maybe I should say if that risk is anything but low, you're probably going to recommend that they go to the cath lab prior to hospital discharge. And so from the time they present throughout their hospitalization, and then even afterwards, if you haven't already intervened on them in the cath lab, these patients need to receive continual risk assessment. In other words, what is their risk of having recurrent ischemia, recurrent MI, or cardiac death if I continue with just medical therapy? And there are a number of well-known risk scores that you can use, TIMI score. And these are ones that were developed from large trials that were done in acute coronary syndrome, TIMI trial, GRACE trial, Pursuit. And you can find these on the internet. You can probably get apps for some of these. But there are some very simple ones without having to plug a whole bunch of different variables into a formula like with these risk scores. But there's some very simple risk factors that are easy to identify that tells you that this is not a low-risk patient. And I've listed some of those here. So just having an elevated troponin takes them out of the low-risk category. So frequently, unless there's some other relative contraindication for some because of some other medical reason that they shouldn't go to the cath lab, generally they have elevated troponin. So if they have an infarction, not just unstable angina, that is a reason to decide to recommend sending them to the cath lab with the intent of doing angioplasty. Also, new ST segment changes indicates as an indicator of increased risk. Known coronary disease with prior intervention. Elderly patients, and these are all kind of just intuitive things. We know that the older the patient, generally the less well they do when they have an acute coronary syndrome. Adjunctive medical therapy in general with acute coronary syndrome. The only thing I'll say, I mean, everybody knows about using nitrates, but in this day and age with a lot of males on medication for erectile dysfunction, you got to ask about that, got to be very cautious. Usually, I think with Viagra, you want to avoid nitrates for 24 hours. And with Cialis, it's usually, I think, about 48 hours, because if you give them nitrates while that medication is still on board, they can get significantly hypotensive, and you'd like to avoid that. Morphine, believe it or not, is although it's a class one indication in STEMI, in non-ST elevation acute coronary syndrome has been downgraded to a class 2B. So you have to be a little bit cautious with using morphine routinely in patients that do not have ST elevation acute coronary syndrome. Beta blockers, there was a time probably a couple decades ago now where we used to routinely give IV beta blockers in the setting of acute coronary syndrome. We don't routinely do that anymore. It is still good to use if the patients come in with acute coronary syndrome and are markedly hypertensive and tachycardic, but it is appropriate and recommended that oral beta blockers be started within the first 24 hours. The reason why there's caution with the IV beta blockers is because there was a large Chinese trial done a number of years ago, the COMMIT trial, and using aggressive beta blocker therapy early on, there seems to be an increased risk of cardiogenic shock, whereas a little bit later in their course, it does decrease the risk of infarction. And I've just listed the markers of increased risk for cardiogenic shock with aggressive beta blocker therapy early on. So oral, yes, caution with IV beta blockers. ACE inhibitors, usually within 24 hours, and that's as oral dosing, not IV. There was a period of time when we used to use IV ACE inhibitors many, many years ago. And the patients that should clearly, in other words, class one indication, are those with anterior MI or those that have a post-MI ejection fraction of 40% or less, or patients with congestive heart failure. So all those patients should, it's a class one indication to start ACE inhibitors. But there is some pretty good evidence that maybe all patients, regardless of how stable and how good their ejection fraction is, would benefit from ACE or ARB. And so that's, although not a class one indication, still pretty good evidence that we should probably be doing that. So in other words, starting ACE inhibitors prior to hospital discharge. What about aldosterone antagonist? I think Dr. Burke already alluded to this. So patients in the hospital post-infarction, so the indications are ejection fraction 40% or left and either symptoms of heart failure or a diabetes. So the 40% or less EF is key to both those categories, but then either heart failure or a diabetes on top of that should prompt you, and it's a class one indication to add an aldosterone antagonist. Statin therapy, unless there's some medical reason why you shouldn't because of previous intolerance, they should just all be placed on high-intensity statin therapy. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories are all contraindicated during hospitalization for acute coronary syndrome. Complications mentioned briefly. So both hemodynamic and electrical instability may occur during hospitalization for acute coronary syndrome. And these patients are usually ones where they need to be stabilized rapidly and then transferred to a center with cath lab that's PCI capable and also cardiac surgery capable. And the echo is usually key here as far as trying to sort out why they are hemodynamically unstable. Is it because they just have pump failure, in other words, a poor left ventricular ejection fraction or right ventricular dysfunction or maybe both, as opposed to the less common complication with acute MI, and that is a mechanical complication where they rupture some portion of the myocardium, which results in either acute MR or acute septal rupture or even free wall rupture. You need to identify these patients rapidly, stabilize them, and get them to a place where they are surgery capable so that they can be repaired. Otherwise, they will frequently not survive the hospitalization. However, one interesting complication is right ventricular infarction, and this is certainly not rare. Usually occurs in the setting of acute inferior MI. So patients that come in with inferior myocardial infarction, you need to kind of have your antenna up looking for right ventricular infarction. And there's a very nice clinical triad of hypotension with elevated neck veins but clear lungs in a patient with acute inferior infarction. Think right ventricular infarction. And the reason why it's important is because if you have an inferior infarction that's complicated by right ventricular infarction, the prognosis is much worse than those patients that have inferior infarction without right ventricular infarction. And there are some things you can do from a medical standpoint, IV volume loading and catecholamines, but really the important thing here is early reperfusion, as it is with most problems with acute coronary syndrome. Arrhythmias, I won't spend too much time here. There's a lot of reasons why patients may require at least temporary pacing, and some of these don't seem too bad. So if somebody comes in with develops a new right bundle, you actually should be aware that is a marker of perhaps having progression and developing complete heart block. And you may not necessarily put a temporary wire in a patient that just develops a right bundle, but you need to at least be capable of having a transcutaneous pacer available. Nonetheless, these are the indications for temporary pacing in the setting of acute infarction. And I won't spend much time on this other than you should probably understand the distinction between early and late ventricular tachycardia. Late is usually 48 hours after their MI. So things, ventricular ectopy that occurs after 48 hours, you have to be careful with. And then there's the patients that are post-discharge, and when do I make a decision to send them to the electrophysiologist to have at least a prophylactic ICD put in for reduced ejection fraction. And that's why follow-up evaluation of left ventricular ejection fraction post-infarction is important, especially if they were identified as having significant reduction in their EF during the hospitalization. They get treated, they go home, and then you need to reevaluate them. And this time frame, since most patients get revascularized nowadays, usually the decision on whether or not to put in an ICD post-infarction in somebody with reduced ejection fraction is usually going to be made at 90 days. We already talked about risk stratification. So if you are haven't already sent, revascularized patients, you need to at least plan on doing either pre-discharge or early discharge stress testing if you've taken or if you've decided to follow an ischemia-guided strategy. And these are just highlights on secondary prevention. So one thing is that this is problematic since AFib is rampant, and a lot of people with acute coronary syndrome are already on anticoagulant therapy. And, you know, what do you do about that after they've had an acute coronary syndrome? You know, what do you send them home on? Just antiplatelet therapy? Do you send them home on two antiplatelet agents and an anticoagulant? Do you send them home on an anticoagulant and only one antiplatelet agent? I don't have an easy answer for that one. It's a frequent dilemma that we see. But I will say that we usually, if they have a significantly elevated CHADS VAS score and they're not somebody that you want to hold their anticoagulant, we'll usually send them home on triple therapy unless they're very high bleeding risk. And then after 1 month, 3 months, maybe 6 months, we'll stop the P2Y12. In other words, we'll stop either the clopidogrel or whatever else you're using. We'll stop the aspirin and leave them on just an anticoagulant and one of the P2Y12 agents. And then at the end of 1 year, we'll then bring aspirin back on board and get rid of the P2Y12 and obviously maintain them on anticoagulant therapy. So that's the only kind of sticky issue, I think, with antithrombotic therapy post-infarction is the patients that maybe require triple therapy at least for a period of time. Questions? All right, what do we got next?